Ave and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast in which we look at the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me as always is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a lecturer in Ancient Mediterranean Studies at La Trobe University. This is episode XXV.
Really?
Apparently it is. This is episode XXV, Livia. A while ago we put out the call for topics that you'd like to hear about in Emperors of Rome, and Livia is one of those topics. The first listener who asked for it was Alares Alamon, but it's coincidentally the person that Rhiannon also wanted to most cover. Livia is best known by association, the wife of Augustus and the mother of Tiberius, but ultimately the best well-known Empress of Rome. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
Livia comes from a really important patrician family, and she's born at a very interesting time. She's born in about 58 BCE, which means she comes to adulthood exactly when the Republic is falling apart. So she's from that really aristocratic background. Her father is from the family of the Claudii, the Claudiuses. He's adopted into the Drusus family, so she's often called Livia Drusilla.
That means second child?
It almost certainly does, because the ill bit in Drusilla means little. It's a sort of diminutive, which might mean that she had an elder sister called Livia Drusa. So that was to identify her. But we have no evidence for that sister. We know she had a brother. But as I say, she comes from this big, important Republican family. And that means that she is somebody who's going to be married off to important Roman men.
Her father was a senator?
Her father was. She had consuls in her family. She's got exactly a kind of impeccable patrician background.
What is the role of a young woman in her ranking in that society? Is it simply to be someone to marry off in a bit of a power play, really?
That's often what aristocratic women in Republican Rome were used for, and to a certain extent this continues in Imperial Rome too, that there are a certain very small number of families that really control Roman politics. And even though we have voting at this period and we might think of it as sort of democratic, it's an oligarchy. It's controlled by very, very few. And the way that they bind one another together is through marriage. So they want to make an alliance with another Roman aristocrat. They will marry their sister or daughter to somebody from that family.
So does this happen to Livia then?
Yeah, Livia marries well, as would be expected. She marries a man called Tiberius Claudius Nero, who's also from the Claudian family.
Yeah, I recognize all of those names, yes.
Yes, yes, they're all going to be significant names in the empire, as we've already really gone through. And they all really come from this man that Livia marries. He doesn't get to be emperor, but he is the father of emperors.
Yeah, yeah. So is he a senator?
Yes, absolutely.
So you say
also patrician.
Also patrician. So this happens all around the fall of the Republic. So which side of the sword does Livia and her husband Tiberius Claudius Nero fall?
The wrong side in every single way. Livia's on the wrong side in terms of who her father backs.
Right.
So her father is on the Republican side, the non-Julius Caesar side in the First Civil War. And then her husband backs the assassins of Caesar. He's not part of the conspiracy to kill Caesar, but afterwards he suggests that the assassins should be congratulated. So obviously he's not on Octavian's side, wanting to get revenge. Then he's also on the wrong side against Octavian. He backs Mark Antony. So all the way along, they pick the wrong person. But it really doesn't seem to matter. When it comes to Livia, she seems to escape all of that scot-free.
So I imagine that it goes quite poorly for them during the Civil War.
They're given amnesties both times. There's a point at which you don't kill off all of your enemies in either of these civil wars, although vast numbers of people were proscribed. Livia's father and husband weren't proscribed. They weren't put on that list where you could kill them with impunity. But her husband did flee to Greece initially and only came back when the amnesty was issued.
So at this point, Livia's got one child, Tiberius, and is pregnant with another. What do we know about her specifically during this period before she comes back from Greece? Is she just along for the ride with her family?
We don't know anything about her. There's very little written about her. And really, all we know comes out in the biography of Augustus, so Suetonius's biography. And of course, Suetonius is primarily interested in her when she meets Augustus in 39 BCE. And he does also talk about her, especially in the biography of Claudius. She's Claudius's grandmother.
Mm.
So she comes up in both of those biographies, but her early life is a bit of a mystery apart from that, except that we know she's married at about 15. And by the time she's 19, she's got one son and another one on the way. So she's about 20 when she gets involved with Augustus, or as he is at that time, Octavian.
Her husband and by extension her are granted an amnesty and go back to Rome.
Mm-hmm.
She's married. Augustus is married as well to his first wife.
Mm-hmm.
How did that go from meeting somebody who is essentially a traitor and was on the enemy's side to getting married? And that happened really quickly as well.
It did. In fact, it seems to have all happened in 39 BCE. Octavian divorces his wife supposedly on the day that she gave birth to their daughter.
That's really rough.
Julia, that's pretty nasty, isn't it? Except I guess we should remember that divorce is very, very common in the Roman world. And not to say that people didn't always get emotional about it, but amongst aristocratic families, it seems to have been regarded as something that you shouldn't take personally almost. Because marriages are alliances with other families, this could be regarded as Octavian deciding to make a new
alliance. I feel you're making excuses for him.
I know it's very difficult to think of it in those terms. But then marriage and divorce is made for dynastic purposes. It's very cold way of thinking about it from our point of view, but it's exactly how the Romans did think about it.
So if you're thinking about it from that perspective, then it's strategically wise for Augustus to be married to Livia. Why is that? Is she significant? Is her family a good choice?
Well, I've said you can look at it in a very cold way. She is. I mean, she's from a significant Republican family, so she's definitely not a bad choice. But Suetonius suggests that it is a real love match, and that's kind of why it happens so quickly. He wants to get rid of his wife Scribonia and get married to Livia, that it's almost a love at first sight type. You know, he marries her while she is still pregnant by her first husband, which is very unusual because potentially that leads to all kinds of questions about whose son this is. Now, Octavian never claims that the second son, who's called Drusus, is his, but there were always rumors that Drusus might actually be his love child.
But they waived the waiting time.
They did.
So this is all really rushed. And what did Tiberius Claudius Nero, the first husband, what did he make of all of this?
Well, he was persuaded to get divorced, and we can only imagine that for him this was something pragmatic, given, as we've mentioned, he's on the losing side. This is a way of kind of ensuring that his family's okay, because his sons will become the stepsons of the man who's on the winning side, the one who's going to be a very significant player in Rome. Now, he doesn't know that Octavian is going to become the first emperor of Rome at this point. This is in 39, and it's going to be another 12 years before Augustus comes to real power. And even then, a lot of ancient historians feel, I think quite rightly, that, you know, it's not a done deal until the late 20s, until about 23 BCE. You don't know in 27 BCE that everything's going to be very stable. So it's kind of a gamble, but it's a gamble that pays off because then his family is safe. So he's quite complicit with all of this. In fact, he gave her away at the wedding. So Suetonius says, just as a father would. He basically acts as her father in this transaction. Now, I know, again, that sounds very weird to us, but the Romans actually had two forms of marriage. Livia probably wasn't married under this very ancient form, but the very ancient form actually transferred the woman from her father to the power of her husband, and her husband effectively became her father, the paterfamilias. The father has all the power in the Roman family, so he has power over his wife as if she's his child in that kind of marriage. That was a very old-fashioned kind of marriage that was rarely practiced by this period. It's not as weird as it sounds to us. Okay. And that's partly because we've got all of this emotional connection to marriage. You can't imagine your ex-husband coming and giving you away at your second marriage.
Yeah,
it's very weird.
Yeah. A very fast marriage. either a Roman love affair or a strategic power play, or perhaps a bit of both.
I think both, yes.
So on the flip side of it, on the other side of the wedding, what sort of married relationship did Augustus and Livia have?
Well, I think the signs are that it was a very successful marriage because, and there's a sort of negative reason for this, the Romans thought the purpose of marriage was to have legitimate children.
Which now, they didn't have.
They have no children together. There's a miscarriage. They already have children, of course. Augustus has Julia by his previous marriage, and Livia now has two sons. But they don't have any children together, and this would absolutely be grounds for divorce in Roman society. It'd be quite normal for Augustus, as he becomes, to move on and marry somebody else to have more children with, especially because he doesn't have a son. And this is very important for Roman families. But he doesn't do that. So that in itself is a sign that he has a great deal of affection for Livia, that he maintains this marriage for over 50 years.
What do we know about the regard that Augustus held Livia in?
It seems to have been very great. And Livia has more power than any woman we know of previously in Roman society. Now, this is not to say that Republican women never had any power. They probably exerted all kinds of influence. But Livia is given public honors. She is seen more in public. Statues of her are put up so the public can see her. There's a porticus of Livia that's erected, which will obviously have an inscription with her name on it. So she's kind of in your face. You see her if you're in Rome and in other places too. She's given the right to look after her own money. Technically, no Roman woman earned any money. She always had a guardian. But Livia is freed from that guardianship. And there's a law brought in that a woman with three children is freed from that kind of control. She's free from her guardian. Now, Livia doesn't have three children, but she's given that right anyway. So this is another way in which rules are broken a bit for Livia. She's also given the status of what we call a one-man woman. In Latin, it's uni vira, which is, it's not a formal status, but it's sort of a term that's used, and it's something that is regarded very highly, a woman who only marries once. That's a great thing to do, and it's very unusual for Roman aristocratic women because they just married off in succession. Now, Livia is not a one-man woman. She has been married before, as we know, but she's given that title anyway, as if we can just rub out the past. Even though there are these two sons there to prove that she actually was married, it's kind of a weird PR stunt, and people just seem to accept it.
How influential was she in Rome then? Did she have a lot of sway with her husband?
She seems to have had a lot of influence over him, but we can't really say exactly how that demonstrated itself, except that he consulted with her, presumably. What we can say is that she's certainly useful and was probably influential on the kind of moral reforms that Augustus brings in. So if you remember back to the Augustus podcasts we did, there is this whole kind of family values that he's interested in. So he makes adultery illegal, that kind of thing. And Livia, by being presented as this perfect wife, is quite useful to him. He sort of trusts her to have this image. I think that indicates trust, that he knows she's not going to let him down there. And she is supposed to have done things like made his clothes for him. She actually wove them. This is what a good Roman woman traditionally does. But obviously aristocratic women don't have to do that. They've got servants, they've got slaves. But she does it anyway, because that's an important part of her image.
So did she use her position and her influence to further the interests of her two sons?
Absolutely. And this is the main way that we can trace her influence, because both of them are adopted by Augustus and they're set up as heirs, basically, particularly after Augustus's grandsons died, his grandsons by his daughter Julia. And there's no direct line to succeed him. Tiberius is the one who's put forward as the heir from 4 CE. And then, of course, Livia becomes very significant because she's not only the wife of the emperor, she's the mother of the future emperor.
Once a husband dies, it must be hard for a woman to remain relevant and visible in that sort of society, although it would have helped being the mother of the new emperor to some extent. But she seems to have really made her mark and maybe stepped out of Augustus's shadow a bit during this period.
Well, if you think about how long Augustus has been there, he's been princeps or emperor for 41 years by the time he dies. She's kind of an established figure at this point. And she's also left an awful lot of money in his will, and money is power. She gets a third of his estate left to her, and he has, you know, he's enormously wealthy. That's huge. She's also, and this kind of harks back to the whole giving her away as if he's her father, she's adopted by Augustus in his will, which might, again, sound rather strange. But this means that she can now be called, and she is now called, Julia Augusta. So she takes on the female form of Augustus's names. That will actually become an honorific term that's given to a lot of future empresses. So that's an important term. So she's got all of these honors. And as you say, she's now the mother of the current emperor. And she lives for another 15 years.
So she must be a pretty strong reminder then of what was seen as the golden period of Rome.
Not everybody saw it in this way, course, but it's certainly a time of stability.
Yeah.
And there's a certain amount of gratitude for that. And it's also an institution that is becoming permanent. It's not necessarily permanent at this point, but, you know, that family is becoming kind
Pax
of solidified.
Romana.
Yeah, the Pax Romana, the fact that you've got an imperial family and she's a good kind of figurehead for that, I suppose.
Yeah. So she's got an established relationship with one emperor, with her late husband Augustus. How does she get on with the new emperor?
Well, a lot of the accounts say not too well. Okay at first.
Yeah.
But sometime in the 20s, it seems to deteriorate. And as we saw when we did the podcasts on Tiberius, he's a fairly mercurial figure anyway. He can be a bit dour. And according to Tacitus, at the beginning, he sort of refuses lots of titles for himself. For example, Augustus had been father of the country, pater patriae, and he says, no, I don't want that one. And Tacitus has this whole conspiracy theory that this is Tiberius just pretending, and he actually wants to be offered flattery. But as an extension of this, Livia is offered the title mother of the country, and Tiberius won't let her have it. So he's actually sort of not letting his mother have certain honors that the Senate wants to give her. Tacitus and Dio Cassius do represent her as somebody who wants to be too involved. I guess the implication is that she had had a lot of influence with Augustus, and Tiberius gets sick of that. And of course, we know that he goes off into virtual exile in Capri at one point, and the historians theorize that that's because he's sick of Livia. Tacitus says, he says there's a kind of veneer of harmony. And he puts it in a very Tacitian way. He does that thing that we call the invidious alternative. So the quote is, a genuine harmony between mother and son, or a hatred well concealed, existed between them. So in other words, they made it look like they were in harmony with one another. But actually, it was almost too perfect. They were obviously plastering over something. When Tacitus says that, he wants you to think it's the second one. It is a hatred well concealed. He has a very negative view of her.
So when she dies, how is she remembered? How is she regarded?
Part of how she's remembered is mediated by Tiberius, because he won't allow her to be deified. So she's not immediately turned into a goddess, which I think people had expected.
But having said that, it's not normal for a woman of that stature to be turned into a goddess, is it?
Deification and normal is a relative term, isn't it?
Because especially at this
time. If you think about it, there are only two people who've been deified that anyone can remember, Julius Caesar and Augustus. Mm. I guess there's an idea that this will happen to the Augusta. So it's a sort of a snub, but yes, there is no tradition.
But it's a snub as in he actively ensures that it doesn't happen.
Yes. And also, and perhaps more important for the Romans, who are obsessed with making wills and being legalistic, he revokes her will. This is kind of her last bit of power. That's what your will is, deciding how your property will be dealt with. And he says, no, we're not going to bother with that.
Wow, real mother issues, eh?
I think so.
Yeah. But this all kind of comes around again when Claudius becomes emperor, because he does deify her.
He does. So she gets deified in 42, but that's, 13 years after she dies. She dies in 29. You could think of Claudius in a very pragmatic way that, remember, Livia is his grandmother, so this is a way of kind of solidifying his power. But I think that also makes it clear that all of this time it's something that people have been sort of expecting. that it's still worth doing, even in 42.
So I guess that in some ways shows that her reputation was quite good and it's still intact after that time.
It does seem to have been, certainly amongst a lot of Romans. The historians give her a not entirely positive write-up. Tacitus in particular sees her as a quite invidious person, stepmother to the country, to the nation, he calls her, and stepmothers are never good in Greek and Roman texts. He sees her as somebody very scheming and manipulative. Now, that in itself is kind of interesting when we're talking about Roman women, because the opinion that historians and biographers have of them is that they shouldn't really have power. So in a way, almost every prominent Roman woman that we can ever talk about tends to get a bad rap from Roman historians, because they're by and large aristocratic and very traditional. And the fact that this woman has come to prominence leads them to think that there must be something wrong. The men haven't controlled them enough. Mm. So we don't necessarily have to take Tacitus at his word. He has issues with women, to put it lightly. However, we can't really say that there's an entirely positive image of Livia. There were naysayers. There were people who thought of her as having too much power, as having possibly used that power in quite criminal ways. And, you know, it was suggested that she was responsible for some of the deaths in Augustus's family. So there's that rumour going around in the background.
But on the other side of it, 2,000 years later, now, her reputation is quite good. You're, in particular, quite fond of her, aren't you?
I think Livia's great, but I think that's partly because I think she probably was a schemer. And she probably, like Augustus, she knew exactly how to work with the hand that she was given. They're both coming into power at this time when it could have all gone wrong. And the emperors that we've looked at subsequently, they handle the Roman public and the Roman Senate in different ways, and they all do it wrong in some way. Even Claudius, who's not too bad, he ends up annoying the Senate. He ends up killing senators. Now, Augustus had been responsible for the deaths of many of them in the civil wars. But as we've seen, he issues an amnesty. He manages to keep on the right side of the right number of people so that he's not in danger. He manages to have this period of 40 years of peace. Now, I'm not saying that I think that Augustan Rome would have been the place that I would have wanted to live at all. I don't think I'd want to have been Livia's friend. But I think that she's an admirable person in that she knows how to work the power play. I don't think that Livia was a nice woman, but I think she was a very intelligent empress.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, lecturer in Ancient Mediterranean Studies at La Trobe University. And you've been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can find it and subscribe on iTunes. And if you're already subscribed and you like this podcast, please leave us a review there. You can find the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, where 600 of you have now admitted that you like the podcast. And you can follow both of us on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I'm at Nightlight Guy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, in 2 weeks' time, we'll be looking at the life and philosophy of Seneca. So until then, as always, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.